From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as states continue to reopen, we've reported on an uptick in COVID-19 cases. Well, now some states are reporting an increase in COVID-19 hospitalizations. Texas, California, Mississippi, Arizona, Utah, Oregon, Arkansas, and the Carolinas all are seeing upticks since Memorial Day. And there are questions about recent comments from the World Health Organization on exactly how the virus is spreading. So let's get a COVID update from Drew Joseph, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Drew.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. And first start with this increase in hospitalizations. That means severe illnesses. You know, we've been seeing, as we said, a daily increase in cases. That's in 22 states. That was thought to be partly due to increased testing, maybe due to Memorial Day gatherings. Now hospitalizations, what does that mean?
Yeah, so it's important to look at a couple metrics when you're trying to gauge where in the epidemic the U.S. is. And it's also important, as you were mentioning, to look at what's happening at states and in individual communities, because this is just how it's going to be for a while. Some states are going to be decreasing, some states are going to be increasing. Testing has definitely gone up, as you mentioned. And so there was a sense that maybe as testing expands, case counts might grow just because you're getting a more accurate sense of where the outbreak actually is. But what's concerning is in some states, the percentage of tests that are coming back positive is actually increasing. So that actually sort of reflects that maybe there's more virus just generally out there. And that's what you're also seeing with hospitalizations as well.
And let's get to the comments from the World Health Organization. Again, they tried today to clarify these comments earlier in the week when one official said it's very rare for people to spread the virus if they don't have symptoms, if they are asymptomatic. Now, she's now calling that a miscommunication. Today, the WHO director, General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said more research is needed to find out how much asymptomatic spread, you know, spread without symptoms, is happening, although he is very clear about people with symptoms.
Here is what we do know, that finding, isolating, and testing people with symptoms and tracing and quarantining their contacts is the most critical way to stop transmission.
But Drew, this is confusing because people can be pre-symptomatic, meaning they just don't have symptoms yet, as opposed to those infected who will never get symptoms, asymptomatic. You know, the takeaway we've all had is we have to stay away from everyone because we just don't know who's who. The research that we do have, what does it tell us about asymptomatic spread?
Yeah, so this kind of miscommunication comes up when you're trying to explain sort of nuanced science and sort of ongoing science, because again, this virus is so new to the public, and sometimes some of those nuances get lost. So, right, the quote unquote very rare comments from Monday came from a WHO expert, Maria Van Kerkhove, and what she was talking about was just what a couple studies have shown from people who are truly asymptomatic. And their point broadly was that this is still early and there's still research being discovered. And so they can't quite know just how often spread is happening from people who are truly asymptomatic. And those are people who will just never show symptoms. I think some of the confusion happened because sometimes asymptomatic is used to refer to people who are pre-symptomatic, you know, people who eventually go on to develop symptoms. Right. And it is widely known that people who are pre-symptomatic are driving at least a substantial portion of the spread.
Yeah. And just very briefly, the D.C. National Guard says some of its members responding to protests have now tested positive. When will we have a sense of whether the virus spread among protesters? In just a few seconds.
It can be a couple weeks between when people get infected and when they start showing symptoms, and then for those to show up in the hospital. It can take a few weeks. So it's something you need to kind of keep an eye on going forward.
And how is the National Guard? I mean, this could be very serious for them if some have tested positive.
Yeah, I mean, that was a concern. It wasn't just among the people who were attending the protests. It was also about the law enforcement and National Guard members who were there. You know, were they wearing masks? Were they attempting to distance? Like, there were a lot of concerns that spread would happen. But to see how widely that occurred, that'll take a few weeks for that to get sorted out.
Okay, Drew Joseph, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Courtrooms across the country are figuring out how to reopen after months of delayed proceedings because of COVID-19. The state of Oregon restarted trials last month in Texas. A court near Dallas held a one-day civil trial by video conferencing, and some courthouses in Ohio are now open. But bench and jury trials are still on hold while officials tackle the obstacles to holding court during this pandemic. Matt Richman from WCPN IdeaStream reports.
26-year-old Seth White had sat in the county courthouse in Ashland, Ohio, charged with child endangerment. He wore a mask and listened to his lawyer, Adam Stone, interview potential jurors in an experiment to see how the court might start holding jury trials again. It did not go well.
My client could not breathe, had to pull his mask off, started shaking, was sweating, had the fever. By the time he got to the hospital, we had to carry him out of the courtroom. At that point, I knew we could not go forward.
Whited was taken to the hospital. His coronavirus test came back negative. The judge said it was likely a panic attack. Stone says there were safety measures put in place. The courtroom was rearranged to allow for social distancing, and when distancing wasn't possible, masks were required. But he still wasn't comfortable.
By the time we came back the second day, I was prepared that if the judge wanted us to go forward, I wasn't going to go forward. But by the time we got back in chambers and had a conversation about it, very lively conversation about it, we were able to come to the consensus that we needed to move the trial.
The new date is June 29th. One of the observers of the session was Ian Friedman, president of the Cleveland Metropolitan Bar Association, and he was troubled by what he saw.
Would I keep my mask on to be safe, and then I can't talk to my client, I can't speak clearly, court reporters can't hear me, or am I going to take it off so that my client gets the best of me, but put my health in greater jeopardy? I mean, what a horrible choice to make.
Friedman is chair of a working group that sent recommendations for restarting jury trials to the Ohio Supreme Court. The group surveyed prosecutors, defense attorneys, sheriffs, and court personnel to find out what each thought would be needed to restart.
We have to have all of this decided before we bring people into the courtrooms. If we make a single mistake in the room, if we realize mid-trial that, hey, maybe we should have done something different, the consequence could be grave. Someone could die.
Social distancing in a jury trial is a problem from beginning to end. Usually hundreds of potential jurors sit shoulder to shoulder in a confined space waiting to be called. The selected jurors sit in a jury box that offers no space for social distancing. They deliberate in a small, closed room. Some of the solutions being considered include larger off-site locations for jury selection. The idea of holding trials via Zoom has started to gain popularity. A one-day civil trial was held in Texas, with all the jurors logging on remotely. Courts in Pierce County, Washington are using video conferencing for non-jury proceedings like custody hearings. But Friedman says the idea is a non-starter for criminal defense attorneys.
In the criminal matters, it becomes a problem because every defendant has a right to confront their accusers. And so the question is, are you able to effectively confront your accuser if it's on video only?
Friedman says that's not possible. So courts in Ohio are focused on having safe courtrooms when they start bringing people back in. Jurors could be spread out among the benches where the audience usually sits. The audience could watch a live stream. The Franklin County, Ohio courthouse has already installed plexiglass partitions between every participant in its courtrooms. Friedman says all these issues will have to be resolved before jury trials resume. In Ohio, the Supreme Court has allowed courts to delay trials through July. Cuyahoga County Administrative Judge Brendan Sheehan says his court is working to be ready to go by then.
We could average 300 people in with 34 courtrooms into this building on a single day for jury service. And with social distancing, we do not have the capability to do that.
So they've started a call-in system to reduce the number of potential jurors that will have to come to the courthouse. The goal of their preparations, says Sheehan, is to make sure people feel safe when they get called for jury duty.
When things were normal, people got their jury summons, they were upset, they were disgruntled that it disrupted their lives. Imagine today getting a jury summons, what that would do to an individual.
Sheehan says Cuyahoga County also plans to excuse jurors who are especially vulnerable to coronavirus if they don't feel comfortable serving. He issued a set of rules governing how many people are allowed in each courtroom, on the elevators, and on each floor when trials begin again. In the last 2 months, the backlog of cases waiting for trial in Sheehan's court and courts across the country has become daunting. Soon everyone is going to have to open up their courtrooms one way or another. For Here and Now, I'm Matt Richmond in Cleveland.
This morning, the chief of police in Minneapolis outlined a preliminary plan to reform the department. This comes 2 weeks after the death of George Floyd, which sparked protests and calls to defund and even dismantle police departments across the country. Chief Madaria Arredondo says he will start by immediately withdrawing from contract negotiations with the police union, often seen as an obstacle to reform.
We know that the time is now. And it would be the greatest disservice in policing if we did not use the will and the energy and the inspiration to make some significant changes nationwide as it relates to race and policing.
Let's take a big picture view of policing with Lorenzo Boyd, director of the Center for Advanced Policing at the University of New Haven in Connecticut. He joins us on Skype. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You've studied policing for several years. You were once a sheriff and a corrections officer. And thinking about police reform or this idea of dismantling, you've said we need to go back to the origins of policing in this country, and that is slave patrol. Why is this detail important in the context of this moment?
We've been pretty much doing policing the same way for the last 300 or 400 years. Before we had organized the police departments, particularly in the South, the slave owners would reach out to a bunch of vigilante citizens and tell them, I need help protecting my plantation. So they said, if you capture the slaves and bring them back, we'll pay you money. So then they started to be night riders riding around these rural areas looking for slaves not on plantation. So that kind of morphed into Southern policing in this country. And we see remnants of that because a lot of Southern police departments either started through the KKK or had many Klan members in them. So that moved forward. And today there's a lot of communities in the South that reportedly have a lot of Klan members still in it. And we have the mentality that the police dictate the actions. Upwards of 90% of policing is reactive. So if we change the focus of policing and make policing more proactive and deal with community issues and not just focus on crime, then I think we've got a chance of actually making a difference.
But Lorenzo, community policing is not new. Why has it not been implemented across the board?
Community policing looks very different in different communities. In order for us to effectively use community policing, we have to convince police administrators that their main priority is not simply fighting crime and not simply answering 911 calls. And that's a paradigm shift because in policing, it's numbers driven, the amount of crimes reported, the amount of arrests made. And it's hard to quantify the amount of crimes that didn't happen. And it's hard to quantify the time that an officer spends in the community building relationship. So if we can move from the reactive paradigm into a more proactive paradigm, then community policing is a wonderful thing and it can work really well.
This speaks to something else. I used to be a police beat reporter, and I remember hearing a lot that the primary mission for a beat officer is to make it home at night. And you've said that is a flawed way of framing a mission because it essentially creates an us versus them relationship with communities.
Yeah, the tacit premise of that line of thinking is that the community members are the enemy, which is kind of a militaristic view of doing policing, which is problematic because we want the officer clearly to come home safely, but we want community members to be safe and we want the relationship to build. So if you already think that there's an adversarial relationship, then it's doomed for failure.
You know, there have been efforts to increase the number of women and people of color at departments throughout the country, but you've also said that's not enough, that we need to think of the culture of policing as a battleship that we can't just turn around on a dime. Can you say more?
The best quote that I heard came from the former commissioner of Chicago, Gary McCarthy, right after he was removed. When he was doing his interviews, he said, people think that the police are racist. But that's not realistic. The police themselves are not, you know, don't have a race problem. America has a race problem, and the police are just a reflection of that. So if you think about how we move through policing and who we bring into policing, and if we train police to be more more compassionate, or we train them on diversity issues, if you go in and do a 1 8-hour training, most police officers spend 900 hours in the academy. So if we just add 8 hours of diversity training, that's not going to do a lot, you know, one time. And I've been training police officers for 20 years. Recently, when I started training police in the last few years, I tried to bring community members in because I want the police to understand the lived experience of the people in the community. I want to put a face to some of the things that they think are problematic. So when you bring people in and you see these are moms and dads and kids and people that are really trying to do the right thing, then you can't view the community as just a group of others or a group of potential offenders. You actually get to see them as people.
Yeah. There's been adversarial relationships in cities and towns throughout the country with having community boards that assess police and what they're doing and having that relationship. Are you seeing that change?
In some places, because you've got a bunch of progressive chiefs that are coming on and trying to change what's happening in their communities. You know, you can see chiefs like Gina Hawkins in Fayetteville or CJ Davis in Durham or Danielle Outlaw in Philadelphia. But again, if you notice, these are chiefs of color. These are black women chiefs. So from the top, if we're changing the perspective, because many people that are chiefs have been on the job 20 years, 30 years. So they were trained under the old mentality. So if we can get the chiefs to see a better way, and then we can train the command staff and then work its way down, and then we can continuously train line officers, then I think we've got a chance of moving forward.
What about the idea of budget cuts? So Los Angeles and New York City and Minneapolis, as we've been talking about, are all proposing a cut to police budgets, arguing that reforming police is actually the first step, and spending that money on improving community service like access to mental health care should be a priority. Do you think that that's a good idea?
I think that's a fantastic idea. But let's think, that's not a new idea, because we've been reallocating resources every year forever. It's not unusual that a mayor or a city council would say we need to pull somebody out of the police budget to put it in other places, because in most places, 80, almost 90% of a police budget is personnel and benefits. So taking some of that out, and a lot of it is overtime, and taking that out, putting it in community services makes sense. Because remember, crime is not the problem. Crime is symptomatic of much bigger problems in society. And the reason we have crime is because we have addiction, we have homelessness, we have transiency, we have lack of education, we have underemployment. We have all these social problems that together lend themselves to criminality. So if we can solve some of these problems before they become crimes, then we can let the police focus on the service mentality that they were supposed to do. And the problem is we use the police as a giant dumpster, and we put all of society's problems on the police, and the police are ill-equipped to handle every problem from society.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because in many ways, a big portion of their work is social work. I want to ask you about something else. So Democrats in Washington want to end qualified immunity, which shields officers from lawsuits. They're also proposing making it easier to charge officers with federal civil rights violations. Are these measures that you feel would lead to reform?
I do think it's going to lead to reform, because a lot of police officers seem to operate under some level of impunity. And many officers don't think they're going to get in trouble for their actions, and they certainly don't think they're going to be charged. So if we can put that back out there, because the rest of society works like that, we know that we can be charged civilly and criminally for doing bad in the commission of our jobs. So the reform won't affect most police officers, because most officers do the right thing and most officers are good officers, and it's not going to affect them at all.
But what about police unions? They're really powerful, and we've seen in the past that they have been in opposition of many of these police reform ideas.
Yeah, the whole purpose of a union, and I spent the bulk of my career in a union, but the union is supposed to protect officers, and the subculture of policing often protects officers even when they shouldn't. So there needs to be some give and take. I am absolutely pro-union, but I want my unions to be smart. I want the union to realize that protecting bad officers is antithetical to the oath that they've sworn.
What does the police department of the future look like?
That's a fantastic question. The police department of the future is going to have young people who are better educated, not just better trained, but better educated. They're going to have compassion. They're going to have empathy. One of the things that we do at the University of New Haven, at the Center for Advanced Policing, we've abandoned the idea of trying to build a better cop. What we do is we empower citizens and we empower students and give them levels of empathy and give them critical thinking skills. And we try to build a better person and then guide them into policing. I think that's the future of policing. And I think the future of policing could, with reform, be great.
That's Lorenzo Boyd. He is director of the Center for Advanced Policing at the University of New Haven. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
As protests sweep the nation, the subject of policing is once again being hotly debated.
This week on Throughline, how police forces developed in the North and the South in the 19th century and expanded their power in the 20th century.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
There are a lot of frustrated voters in Georgia today, many of them lined up in the heat for more than 4 hours, waiting to vote in yesterday's primary election. The delays were due to a combination of problems at precincts in counties where an overwhelming number of voters are Black and Latino. In Midtown Atlanta, 16,000 voters were assigned to cast ballots at one polling location. For more, we have Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting. And Stephen, there were several reasons for these delays, not to mention the fact that we're still in a pandemic. Why was the voting process such a mess?
Well, Tanya, to start, for months, elections officials have said this is going to be different, voting in a pandemic. You had polling places closed because churches and schools said, we don't want to have people here. You had poll workers, many of them older, drop out, so new ones had to be brought in and trained. And you had social distancing and other health precautions that were going to stretch out lines and have fewer machines in Georgia polling places. So all of this happened before the election, and on election day, a huge number of people showed up to vote in person before the polls even opened. So you had long lines building at 6:45 and 6:50 in the morning that just grew as the day progressed.
You actually spoke to some voters in line. What did they tell you?
Well, here's Lloyd Mitchell in Atlanta's Sandtown voting precinct. It took him 4 hours to vote because election workers found out the machines weren't processing votes correctly.
And they noticed this problem when the polls first opened, and it led to a cascade of events.
Now, those cascade of events played out at several polling places in Fulton County, where Atlanta is, in neighboring DeKalb County, Gwinnett County, and all across the state, as these issues with machines halted voting for several hours. And when things did get running, several more hours took place before people could cast their ballots. I myself even waited 3.5 hours at a precinct that didn't have any issues.
Oh, wow. As I mentioned, the election issues plagued counties where a majority of voters are Black and Latino. What are voting rights activists like former Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams saying about yesterday's issues?
Well, Tanya, many people are saying that what happened yesterday was unacceptable, both Republican and Democrats. The Democratic Party of Georgia says it's a failure of leadership of the Secretary of State, who is a Republican. Stacey Abrams, who's called for voting reform since her own election, where she narrowly lost in 2018. And she says that there's a lot of work that needs to be done between now and November to help make voting work for everyone.
Yeah, that's the big question. Is there an indication that this is going to be ironed out by then?
Well, the Secretary of State's office says a lot of this can be fixed by training. There's plenty of time before an August runoff, they say, for these things to be ironed out, and even more time before November. But many people may shift to absentee ballots. We had record absentee turnout in this primary, as people don't trust these election machines or don't want to spend half of their day waiting in line.
That's Stephen Fowler. He's a politics reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
Let's get the view now of the Trump presidency from a Republican. Now, it's just one voice, but it's a very powerful one, getting a lot of attention. Dan Eberhardt is a big Republican donor, an avid supporter of the GOP, and for a long time of President Trump, despite disagreements here and there about tariffs and trade. But things have changed enough that other Republicans are taking notice. Eberhardt is managing partner of Eberhardt Capital, CEO of the Canary LLC Oil Field Services Company. He's criticized some of the president's pandemic response and what he's called Trump's bravado. Dan Eberhardt joins us by Skype from Florida. Dan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How would you characterize your dismay with President Trump's handling first of the pandemic?
First of all, I think that he's done a good job with the economic response and with some of the response to, you know, the actual pandemic and the rollout. But I think there's a lot to be critical of. First, I think the administration should have had more preparatory planning. Second, I think the administration has been a little bit tone deaf to what people are going through and the economic and health consequences. And finally, I think that the Trump administration needs to be more uplifting and more cognizant of the health challenges going forward. And I think they just, quite frankly, seem a little bit flat-footed.
Back in March, when President Trump was downplaying the coronavirus, he said he'd have the country open by Easter. You said then, if he tries to restart the economy too soon and the pandemic continues to spread, that will be his legacy and it will be one of failure. You know, people were showing up on beaches on Memorial Day, and they were saying, if President Trump isn't wearing a mask, I'm not going to wear a mask. Are you still worried about a second wave and what that might mean for the Trump presidency?
I'm absolutely worried about a second wave. And I think that there's a lot to fault Trump on in terms of reopening the economy, trying to do it too soon, and, you know, kind of sidestepping what the scientists think were the correct response to the pandemic.
But also then maybe sidestepping the role of president. A study released Monday showed these shutdowns prevented 60 million U.S. infections. But in mid-April, the president said he had total authority to open the state's economies. At that point, you told The Washington Post, I'm almost positive James Madison fell off a cloud somewhere when Trump said that. The founders of the republic stitched together a complicated game of chess to ensure our president was a very weak king and his authority is far from total. I have to ask you, why you'd be surprised. The president's critics have long said that with supporters like Bill Barr, who absolutely believes in executive power, the president has been doing this for a while. He didn't respond to subpoenas, won't show his tax returns, issues a mandate about masks, and then says, it doesn't apply to me. You know, some people might say James Madison has so tumbled off that cloud, rolled over quite a few times already.
Well, first of all, you know, I think that everyone is, as citizens of the republic, should want James Madison on the cloud, not falling, in terms of the presidency is supposed to be somebody subject to checks and balances. And so some of those other items you mentioned, they weaken at the edges. Him just asserting he has total and unfettered authority directly just really blew me away, and I actually took to Twitter. Just really took me off guard and made me kind of upset, because that's not the response we want to our leader dealing with the pandemic. And, you know, now with these protests needing to have a more inclusive and more proactive view. I think that during the George Floyd tragedy, that Trump has been too focused on his base with this law and order rhetoric and not focused enough on the country as a whole and being the unifier in chief and that informal position that he holds, as well as being focused on the needs and sensibilities of communities of color. Those are things that I worry about. And I think, you know, if there were, you know, James Madison's, you know, 12th removed great, great, great grandson, you know, would also be concerned about that, you know, we need checks and balances, not bravado and an unchecked king. And that's not what people voted for. And that's not what our system is in America.
Well, you say you're disappointed in his response to the African-American community, which is in anguish. Again, you know, I can hear some people listening saying, this is a man that you supported, and it was well known. His family company years ago had to settle a huge lawsuit for the way blacks were treated in the Trump company buildings. He led the false claim that the so-called Central Park Five were responsible for an attack in the park. They were clear to that, and the president, now president, but Donald Trump, kept, you know, took out a full-page ad accusing them of that. He falsely claimed the first African-American president wasn't born in the U.S. So, you know, some might say they didn't have an expectation that he'd be able to speak to the black community. You know, why did you?
Well, when you vote for presidents, it's a binary choice. And so on a fundamental basis, I'm more conservative, and everyone should have, you know, hope in who they vote for, that the office is bigger than them and they're going to rise to the occasion. And I think that Trump has just been two steps behind and two steps too far to the right for what this country is going through in 2020 right now.
Well, and do you worry about the impact not just on the attempts to reelect the president, but on your party? The president came out with that phrase, when the looting starts, the shooting starts.
That phrase was ill-advised and should have remained somewhere in his cortex, not been put out into the universe.
He also has been calling himself the law and order president, which, of course, is reminding us of the other president who did that, who was Richard Nixon, who sent the National Guard to, ultimately, they shot and killed college students, led to Richard Nixon's downfall. Are you worried that this isn't just about the reelection, but this is about your party?
I am worried. I think that this kind of division and discontent is a result of many things, but I would really like to see Trump consider himself to be the unifier in chief and to really work to heal the divides, to try to govern from the middle and be compassionate to communities that are really reaching and grasping for help, mm-hmm. and to really try to understand where those folks are coming from and what we as a country can do to lift them up and bring them with us on this American journey.
If the economy suddenly turns around, can you forgive everything else?
I don't know that I can forgive everything else, but I think that a vote in November is a vote for what you want the future of the country to look like. And it's also going to be a referendum on what Trump's done. Those are things that I'm going to have to weigh. There's been a lot of good come out of his administration in terms of economic growth, regulatory rollback, judicial appointments and things like this, and this kind of thrust of conservatism. But as far as being able to heal the country, I think that he's just struggled with that role. And that's something that's going to weigh on my mind in November.
What do you say to people like Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton? We know he wrote the op-ed calling for more military response early on in the protest. He says that what President Trump has to do is say, I will protect you, Democrats won't. You've been quoted as saying Trump's reelection chances are going down in flames when buildings are on fire and police precincts burn. Are you saying the same thing as Tom Cotton?
No, absolutely not. I do think that the handling of the protesters and the rioters, you know, is definitely going to affect how people perceive Trump and definitely going to factor in when the election happens in November. And I think right now, I think that's going to negatively impact his reelection chances in the fall. I think that's completely different from Cotton's op-ed. You know, I think we need some law and order, and I think we need to respect police officers and the police force that does a good job. But I think we've got to take a serious look at over-policing and what's going on. I absolutely think bringing in the military and the National Guard is the wrong move. Mm-hmm. That's something that should happen in a banana republic, not in the United States of America, not in George Washington's republic.
Dan Eberhardt, I have to ask you, what have you heard from fellow Republicans? Are you hearing from people saying, what the heck are you doing here? I mean, what's been the response?
I had a quote that I said something along the lines of, Republicans are headed for extinction in the suburbs if they don't distance themselves from the NRA. And Phil Murphy called me and like three members of Congress. And I was like, wow, that got through. You want to be a member of a party and you want to place a vote in the November election for the kind of America you want and the kind of America you aspire to have. And that's how people should think about how they vote, in my opinion.
Dan Eberhardt, longtime Republican donor, Trump supporter early on, and you just heard criticism. He's managing partner of Eberhardt Capital and CEO of Canary LLC. Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me. I wonder what kind of phone calls I will get.
If you haven't already noticed, brands and businesses want you to know they support Black Lives Matter. From Netflix and Peloton to the makers of Tasers and the fruit snack Gushers, companies are issuing statements supporting social justice movements. Amazon, in particular, drew attention for its statement supporting the protest movement, which critics said was at odds with the company's record on labor rights. Amazon followed up with a pledge last week to donate $10 million to organizations, including Black Lives Matter and the NAACP. But our next guest says these corporate displays of so-called solidarity look like cynical attempts to capitalize on Black death. Misha Fraser-Carroll is a journalist and opinions editor at the UK-based Gale Dim magazine. Misha, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You wrote an op-ed for The Independent that we'll link at hereandnow.org, but you criticized these corporate calls for solidarity as empty statements. One company you criticize in particular is Amazon. They released a statement after the killing of George Floyd that read, "Together we stand in solidarity with the Black community, our employees, customers, and partners in the fight against systemic racism and injustice." You actually called that absurd. Explain why.
Well, basically, as a journalist who has been covering issues on race for years now, systemically, if you actually look at the actions of these organizations, it doesn't look at all like they commit to anti-racist values. So, for example, Amazon, their workers at the very bottom are disproportionately likely to be people of color and Black people specifically. And there have been a lot of workers' rights violations. Workers at Amazon have said that they are too afraid to go for toilet breaks because they are set on timers and things like this. And Amazon have also been known, I don't think it's a secret now, that they've been known to share information with the police. And obviously, because Black Lives Matter is a movement that predominantly focuses on police brutality, that just seems completely incongruous and kind of hypocritical as a message from Amazon.
But let me ask you something, though. I mean, is it a good sign for Black Lives Matter that corporations feel the need to speak out? I mean, does it help pressure companies and politicians, for example, to further a culture where racial injustice is not tolerated?
So I think it's an interesting question, because I think on kind of the surface level, you might say that it furthers a culture of at least by lip service committing to kind of vague notions of anti-racism. But actually, if nothing's changing concretely, if companies aren't kind of starting at home and interrogating their internal structures, implementing practices like actually introducing fair working conditions for people of color, committing to diversifying within their organizations, tackling racism at home, then I don't think the example that they're setting is really strong enough.
The beauty brand Glossier and Chipotle are among companies that have made large donations along with their statements. Does this make their statements possibly less cynical in your view?
I think it does, because I think although you could argue that any of these kind of donations are still, in a sense, PR, they are still they still do improve the reputation of the brand. And ultimately, as consumers, we do see it and we think that it's good and maybe think that we're more likely to buy from that brand. It is at least doing something. Like Glossier donated $1 million, I think it was, half of which went to Black-owned beauty brands and the other half went directly to Black Lives Matter or anti-racist organizations. It just feels like a bit more of a commitment to concrete change rather than just kind of espousing values of equality or diversity or inclusion that kind of make you think, well, what does that actually mean? What is that going to look like? And I guess that's the thing to emphasize, is like a statement isn't in itself a bad thing, but I think that other kind of concrete actions and concrete commitments to change are really, really important to go alongside these statements of solidarity.
Brands are huge influencers as well. I'm thinking about the way that they can influence our spending habits. could we also see this as a way of changing the hearts and minds of the public?
I think potentially, yeah. These statements can kind of serve as awareness raising, right? So I think that by putting out statements, brands can, without necessarily like making concrete changes within themselves, they can influence like what people are aware of and what they potentially think about. And I think that awareness is really, really key. And I think that is one form of power that brands do have. But obviously, like another, especially when we're talking about really big corporations like Amazon, the main kind of power that they have is actually economic. And I guess it's, yeah, about thinking about not what's like the most economically efficient way of them paying lip service to an issue, which probably is just putting out one statement, but actually like what might be a risk to a brand? Do you know what I mean? And I think that by actually putting their money where their mouth is, that feels like potentially the riskiest, but the most morally important way of influencing people.
That's Misha Fraser-Carroll. She's the opinions editor at Gal Dim magazine. Misha, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.